This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Right, is that as good as it gets? I say that's as good as it gets. Opening up with some authentic Moorish music, some authentic, deep, and traditional Moorish music here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City for reasons which will shortly become clear. My name is Bill Weinberg, by the way, and that golden-voiced woman who we just heard from was Rayasa Fatima Tabamrant, who is the traditional matriarch of the Ait Bamran Berber tribe in the Atlas Mountains of Morocco. And she was singing on a disc entitled Taglagalt, or The Echo of the Atlas, which is available from the Institut du Monde Arabe. Although this is not Arab music, this is Berber music, or the Amazigh people, who were the indigenous people of North Africa, who were there for centuries before the Arabs and numerous other people arrived. And she was singing, these were traditional form known as the Rawais, if I am pronouncing it correctly. And according to the MoroccanMusic.com website, Rawais are wandering poets who sing about current events, love, their devotion to Allah, and the loneliness felt during their travels through the mountains. They will entertain you over shared fava bean soup or tagine spread with bread, olives, and mint tea in the market cafes. Accompanying themselves on lotar and rabab, the music begins with a free-form improvisation that introduces the melody before a structured rhythm ushers in the body of the song. Okay, and what, you may ask, is the lotar and the rabab? Well, the lotar is the traditional Berber lute, and the rabab is the traditional Berber monochord fiddle. So that answers that question. And let's see here. Oh, yeah. So the name of that song was, this is a particularly appropriate song to open with. It's very much in the spirit of WBAI. I'm not going to attempt to actually read the words of the title in Amazigh for fear of mangling the language. But it's basically a song for political skeptics and warning against getting taken in by propaganda and politics. In translation, it reads, "Careful now, don't add dupery to your list of worries. It's better to be informed these days," which is a sentiment I wholeheartedly share. It is certainly better to be informed, and especially in these days when the most cynical and disingenuous of propaganda saturates us. And we'll be saying some more about this later on in the show as well, certainly a perennial theme here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Okay, so but before we get to that, and hopefully I'll do a nice smooth little segue from talking about some very deep issues of cultural identity and ancient history, in fact, to stuff which is more on the contemporary tip. Okay, why are we opening with deep traditional music from North Africa? Well, because it's yesterday, in fact, the 12th of January, was Berber New Year, or Yana Year. And this is 2009 in the Common Era calendar, is 2959 in the Berber calendar. They begin counting from the year 950 BC, which was when the Berber dynasty was established in Egypt under Pharaoh Sheshonq I. That's the 22nd dynasty, known to classical historians as the Libyan dynasty, the first of, I think, three Berber or Libyan dynasties in ancient Egypt. When they, it was during one of these so-called intermediate periods when, in between the classic period and the Persian period, when the empire was in a state of disarray and various outside people were able to establish political control over Egypt. And one of them were the Libyans. The Libyan dynasties were immediately, or the Berbers, as we call them today, the Berber or Libyan dynasties were immediately followed by the Nubian dynasties, by the way, before finally the Persians came in and established their own rule for a period of several hundred years. So this was after immediately after the classic pyramid, the so-called golden age of, Ramses II and so on. So to the Greek historians of the day, the Berbers were known as the Libyans, hence the Libyan dynasties. Then several centuries later, when the Berbers were fighting for Carthage and the Phoenicians against Rome in the Punic Wars, they were known to classical scholars as the Numidians. And then finally, when Rome conquered North Africa, they became known as the Moors, and the entire region of North Africa became known as Mauritania. And this actually was, this is when their authentic name, so to speak, began to enter classical or Western terminology. And this was due to, the Romans came in and they, here, I'm looking for the page where I've got, here we go, okay. The Romans came in, and now, they were the people who officially recorded history, so-called, for, the West, and wrote it down in the form which it's been transmitted to us centuries later, were actually the lords of the land, and were actually learning from the people who they conquered. And the word Moor means country in the Berber language. Moor un-ukesh means the country of God, and that's what they called their own land back in the day. And from that we derive the words, the contemporary names Morocco, Mauritania, which continues to be a country in northwest Africa, and Marrakesh, the city in Morocco, comes directly from the Tamazá or Berber. It's for language. The people are the Amazir. The language is Tamazá. Directly, Marrakesh comes directly from Moor un Ukesh, country of God, in certainly in ancient Tamazá and perhaps in contemporary Tamazá as well. So there you have it. That of course the Moors. Now, in terms of what the who the Moors are in the contemporary world, well, they're kind of a it's sort of a loose term for the peoples of North Africa, and there was sort of a melding of the cultures after, the Arabs came in the 7th century. There was kind of a melding of the pre-existing Berber culture and that of the Arabs. The word Berber, by the way, is sort of a misnomer, and that has to do with the fact that when the so-called barbarians, the Germanic tribes which were assaulting Rome, most notably the Vandals and the Visigoths, in their journeys across Europe, they hopped across the Straits of Gibraltar into North Africa and ultimately assailed Rome from the south. And once again, the Berbers fought for them, and they kind of the word got mixed up. And so the barbarians, the bearded ones, who were Germanic peoples, got mixed up with that of the Numidians, as they had previously been known to the Roman world. And that's how the word Berber comes about. Interesting is also, after this, as I say, 7 centuries after that, more or less, the Arabs come in and their identity sort of merges with that of the Arabs. And then you've got, after they conquer, I believe it would have been in the 9th century, they conquer Spain and establish 500 years of Moorish rule over Spain. That was sort of their classical era, so to speak, and they really were the guardians of high culture and learning and trade and commerce in the Western world at a time when Europe was in its dark ages. And interestingly, this was the culture of so-called Andalus or Andalusia, which was the heart of the Moorish kingdom in Spain. And that also is something of a misnomer. It's a very It's a very odd circumstance of history that the words Andalusia and Vandal are etymologically related, because that had been, of course, before the Vandals crossed over the Straits of Gibraltar into North Africa. They had established their kingdom in Spain. And so Al-Andalus was the land of the Vandals. Andalus, Vandalus. So, and of course, you know, the Vandals then sacked Rome. So the word became synonymous with vandalism, you know, pillaging things. And yet Andalusia, under Moorish rule, became the seat of high culture and in many ways, you know, the heir to Roman civilization in that part of the world. And the classical philosophers who were largely forgotten in the Christian world at that time were kept alive in the libraries of Andalus. So it's a rather paradoxical etymology there. So, also, there's one other etymological point I was going to. Yeah, Yanayar, having a hard time coming up with. That's the name of the Moorish or Berber or Amazir New Year's holiday, traditionally January 12th, starting their calendar 950 BCE before Common Era. That might be etymologically related to February, because, you know, the calendar got tweaked a whole bunch of times, right? I mean, initially, you know, there were only 10 months, and then they added July in honor of Julius Caesar, and then they added August in honor of Augustus Caesar, and so things got tweaked a little bit. So according to the ancient lunar calendar, when it got, you know, translated, and that date got translated into the common calendar, somehow January and February got mixed up. So I think Yanayar might be etymologically related to February. Uncertain. This is stuff which I have gleaned from the AmazirWorld.org website, which is the website of Berber news and culture for the Berber diaspora. And you can just link to all of that. You know, just check out the entry for tonight's show on our own website, morc.info, Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, morc.info. Go to the entry for tonight's show on our website, and all the links will be there for your edification. And it's just a fortuitous circumstance, by the way, that January 12th, Yanayar, Berber New Year, falls just a few days after January 8th, which is the birthday of the noble Drew Ali, who is the founder of Moorish science, a traditional indigenous American Islamic movement. Which, from the standpoint of Orthodox Islam, is would be considered heretical, of course. And you know, it often comes up. You know, people ask me around once a year. You know, I figure I have to do a show which explains why the show is named the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Because people always ask me, why is the show named the Moorish Orthodox Radio Hour? Or they always mangle it. They never get it right, but that's okay. No problem. It's actually an hour and a half. It's not an hour, but whatever, no problem. So, all right, so this is a good opportunity both to wish a happy prophet's birthday to all of our Moorish American listeners out there, and also to take this opportunity to explain why the show is called the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and why the token anti-authoritarian anarchist show on WBAI has a mysterious connection to the Moorish science movement. And to explain this, I am going to turn to the book Scandal, Essays in Islamic Heresy by Peter Lamborn Wilson, who longtime listeners will recall was the founder of this radio show. I inherited it from him low back 15 years ago or so. And later on, Anne-Marie Hendrickson and some other members of our collective, Sharon Gregory, as she was known at the time, and Bob McGill came on board. So we're sort of a collective, although the burden is largely falling on my shoulders of late. But we're still officially a collective. And Peter Lamborn Wilson is sort of our Hierophant Emeritus, founder of the radio show, although I don't imagine he's ever going to appear on these airwaves again. But he was definitely our spiritual progenitor and sort of set the tone, which we try to carry on to the best of our abilities. So I should explain that the book Scandal, Essays in Islamic Heresy, is a study in exactly that. It's a study in how liberatory and anti-authoritarian traditions in the Islamic world have survived in forms which have been considered heretical by Orthodox Islam. So there are chapters in here about the Sufis and about the Ismailis, and about various syncretistic movements in North Africa and Indonesia and elsewhere in the Islamic world, which have sort of merged the pre-Islamic indigenous spiritual traditions with those of Islam. And he's got a very brief discussion in here of Moorish Orthodoxy, which or the Moorish Orthodox Church, which is actually our own sort of DIY religion, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely, which is sort of an offshoot from the Moorish Science Movement. So we'll begin at the beginning with the Prophet Noble Drew Ali, whose birthday we celebrate on January 8th. Reading now from the book Scandal, Essays in Islamic Heresy by Peter Lamborn Wilson. Timothy Drew was born to former black slaves in North Carolina near the end of the 19th century and was later adopted into a local Cherokee clan. According to his own account, he earned a living after the turn of the century as a circus magician. In the course of his travels, he visited Egypt, where he spent a night alone in the Great Pyramid. There he received a revelation, which he wrote down and titled the Circle 7 Quran. In 1913, he founded the Moorish Science Temple of America in Newark, New Jersey, with himself as prophet under the Islamic name Noble Drew Ali. During World War I, the Moors refused to fight for racist America and were persecuted, along with other pacifists. Noble Drew Ali taught equality, not hate, but was driven out of the East by the police. In Chicago, he began printing Moorish passports and making converts, among them Elijah Muhammad, future founder of the Black Muslims. In 1924, the Chicago Temple was raided in a gun battle by police, and Noble Drew subsequently died in jail, undoubtedly beaten to death. A number of his followers claimed to succeed him as prophet, including his chauffeur. The Moorish Science Temple declined in importance in the black community, though it still exists. I had some contact with the Moorish governor of Baltimore, a poetic white-bearded man whose junk shop smelled of rose attar in 1966 and 67, and later with younger members of a branch in Brooklyn. In 1957, an offshoot of the temple was formed by some white bohemians who had Moorish passports. Noble Drew restricted membership to what he called Asiatic races, which included anyone of Celtic descent. White members of the temple were known as Persians. This new splinter group was called the Moorish Orthodox Church of America. Its members were attracted to Sufism, and the temple seemed to meaning the Moorish Science Temple of America, seemed to them a sort of Native American version of Islamic esotericism. These new Moors liked the fact that Noble Drew Ali had been martyred in the cause of freedom, and they admired him for having had the imagination and spirit to found his own religion. The psychedelic movement of the early 1960s brought new converts to the Moorish Orthodox Church in Manhattan, Baltimore, and upstate New York. For a number of years, an underground temple, head shop, and motorcycle garage supported church activities on New York's Upper West Side. Close connections were formed with Ananda Ashram and Timothy Leary's League for Spiritual Discovery in Millbrook. Other branches were founded, but only the above-mentioned have persisted for long. Moorish Orthodoxy, which is now an incorporated religion, has no dogma whatsoever. It is perhaps a loose framework made up of whatever symbols its members find useful, but with a basis in Moorish science and Sufism. The Orthodox element is largely ignored. Within this framework, questions are asked, but no answers provided. An important point. Certain Moors have moved towards Sufism or some other authentic Islamic esotericism. Others have practiced yoga, ceremonial magic, and communal agriculture. Aside from whatever baraka or blessing, the individual members of the church may or may not have gained the MOC, Moorish Orthodox Church, itself could be described as a small but perfect example of heresy as a means of cultural transfer. The Moors were part of an attempt to digest and synthesize newly discovered Oriental culture within a revolutionary and self-liberating vision of American individualism. In this, if in nothing else, the 1960s were a partial success. The Orient is now taken for granted and has become mixed into our own cosmopolitan culture. Thousands of translations and studies have opened up the East, even as its traditional cultures are dying out. No social panacea, no final synthesis is likely to emerge, but the experience of the East continues to deepen and enrich the life of the West. In this subtle and far-reaching process, heresy can play a catalytic role. Okay, three pages from the book Scandal, Essays in Islamic Heresy by Peter Lamborn Wilson. I should say a little bit more just about the words heresy and orthodox, because Peter writes that the orthodox element of the name is largely ignored of the Moorish Orthodox Church. And unless, you know, one wants to view it in the sense of the paradoxical unity of opposites and say that we're utterly orthodox or intransigent in being unorthodox and rejecting all orthodoxy. That's the only sense in which we could consider ourselves orthodox. And you know, just as Moorish science itself, and just like the Nation of Islam, is considered heretical by orthodox Islam, by Islam as it's propagated by, you know, the mullahs of Al-Azhar in Cairo. Well, similarly, a lot of the followers of the Moorish Science Temple of America would consider us white bohemians in the Moorish Orthodox Church to be heretical from their tradition. So, you know, we acknowledge this, and there's plenty of heresy to go around. And nonetheless, here we are, you know, and Peter sort of makes a militant defense of heresy in his book Scandal, Essays in Islamic Heresy, as something which can transmit greater truths, and particularly greater truths, which are keys to self-liberation and spiritual discovery, as opposed to merely accepting dogmas. So read it for yourself. It's available from Autonomedia Books in Brooklyn, New York. And all right, so the link where me and Anne-Marie got on board was through Peter actually spent a good many years after his initial founding of the Moorish Orthodox Church. He flew the coop after the perceived failure of the 60s, quote unquote, and spent a good long time, 10 years or more, in the East, in the so-called Orient, and traveled all the way from Morocco to Indonesia, finally settling in Tehran. And he had to leave with the revolution of 1979, came back to New York City, and, you know, it was the beginning of the Reagan era, and he sort of felt, as a lot of people did at the time, that, you know, the 60s dropout ethic, well, it was time to move on beyond that and to once again embrace activism and political engagement. And he got involved with the Libertarian Book Club. Libertarian Book Club. And I must not be remiss, and I must remember to announce our upcoming anarchist forum later on this evening. The Libertarian Book Club was actually founded by left-wing anarchist exiles from Italy and Spain, exiles from fascism, from Mussolini and Franco, who came to New York in the 30s and 40s. And back then, you know, this was before the word libertarian had been hijacked by the free market right. And there was still a notion of libertarian communism or left-wing anarchism or anarcho-syndicalism as its various more or less synonymous names. So these were, you know, anti-statists who believed in overthrowing capitalism and believed in social revolution. And they founded the Libertarian Book Club in the 1940s to keep alive this tradition, to keep alive this intellectual tradition here in New York City and in the anarchist diaspora. And as you might imagine, the LBC, the Libertarian Book Club, got a new lease on life in the 1960s and 1970s with the surgence of the new left and revived interest in anarchism. And on through the 1980s, you know, lots of, you know, sort of neo-anarchists and hippies and punks got on board with the LBC in addition to, you know, these old school, you know, classical anarchists, quote unquote, who were actually, you know, exiles, as I say, from, you know, Mussolini's Italy and Franco Spain and so on. So, you know, old Italian, Spaniards, Jews who, you know, some of whom had actually known Emma Goldman back in the day. Right. So it was sort of this new generation came on board and I was one of them. And so was our once and future co-host, Anne-Marie Hendrickson. So we got to know Peter in this context because he was also a part of this new wave of anarchists who got on board with the LBC. And and then he also got on board with WBAI and started doing a show called the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. It was established back in the 1980s when, of course, there was this, you know, all these Christian radio crusades and this whole, you know, big revival of the fundamentalist Christian right in this country. So the name Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade was quite explicitly poking fun at all these Christian radio crusades. So that's the origin of the name, okay? So then Peter started doing the show, I believe, in 1988 and started getting tired of it around 1993, thereabouts, and started bringing me in as an understudy. So that's where it all began, right? And eventually he retired entirely, and me and Anne-Marie and the other members of the collective took over the show. And here we are. Now, I sort of, you know, initially I was much more of a, of myself, more of a rationalist, old school kind of anarchist. And I felt initially, you know, sort of like I was saddled with this Moorish legacy, which didn't mean much to me at the time. But I do feel like I've grown into it and I've become much more appreciative of the cultures of the greater Moorish world. And I even found something of in my own path of self-discovery, found something of a of an actual genetic and cultural legacy in my own background to these cultures, which maybe we can talk about more later. But generally, I've, you know, become far more appreciative of Peter's unique merging of the anarchist and heretical Islamic legacies. So I hope that I am carrying on Peter Lamborn Wilson's legacy And maybe some of you old-time listeners who still remember Peter will call in later on. Maybe we'll take phone calls later on and tell me whether I'm holding up to Peter's legacy. All right. Now, I talked about a segue to the contemporary political tip, and I still intend to do that. But first, you know, as long as I brought up the Libertarian Book Club, let me not be remiss in announcing our upcoming anarchist forum. Right. I should also say that for a long time, particularly, you know, beginning in the 1980s, when the word libertarian started becoming more and more associated with the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian right as opposed to the Libertarian left, we felt more and more, you know, like we were just sort of intransigently clinging to the word libertarian and to the name Libertarian Book Club. And that nobody really understood except for us. And, you know, it should be said that there were a few people who, you know, we were sort of ecumenical and continue to be sort of ecumenical anarchists. And our basic leanings are to the left, but very strongly to the left. But there were a few people who were on board. And I'll give a shout out now to my good friend Don Meinshausen, if he's listening out there in federal prison tonight. Or maybe he'll listen to this show on the web at some point after he gets sprung. There were a few people who hung around the LBC back in the day who were coming more from the sort of loose, funky end of the libertarian right tradition, the end which was more concerned with individual liberty as opposed to free market dogmas. But we're still sort of approaching the question from more from the question of you know, individualism and the whole right-wing anarchist tradition going back to Lysander Spooner, if you want to look at it in terms of great granddaddies, as opposed to the majority of us who were, you know, left-wing anarchists. And, you know, if we had to look to any great granddaddy, it would be you know, Proudhon and Kropotkin and so on. So, finally, as a sort of a compromise, recently we've decided that we're going to sort of change our name to the Anarchist Forum. And I say sort of because we haven't completely changed our name. But the way it's sort of been working out is now, instead of, you know, calling it the Libertarian Book Club Forum, we're calling it the Libertarian Book Club Anarchist Forum. That's largely what we do these days. We hold a monthly forum where we have an interesting speaker who does an interesting presentation, and then we have a discussion. So now the forum is called the Anarchist Forum, and the group is sort of also called the Anarchist Forum, although it's still the Libertarian Book Club which organizes the Anarchist Forum, because we can't quite cede the name. We can't quite admit defeat that the great libertarian tradition, the tradition of, you know, ultimate freedom and anti-authoritarianism, has been hijacked by the, what I would consider to be the bankrupt ideology of the free market right, which fails to recognize that whether concentrations of elite power are in private hands or in public hands or state hands, it doesn't make any difference for the people down at the bottom of the social pyramid, right? Centralized power is still centralized power. And it doesn't matter if the people who wield it are in the public sector or the private sector, right? So I consider the name to have been hijacked. And I think that, you know, this is part of a greater dilemma that, you know, along with the name libertarian being hijacked by the free market right, the libertarian tradition on the left is sort of gone by the wayside. Right. And that, you know, back in the 1960s, the left was associated with long hair and smoking dope and rock and roll. You know, today it's associated with, you know, political correctitude and humorlessness and unfortunately, you know, Stalinism has made a huge resurgence on the pathetic little remnants of the left. Huge within the context of the very small pond, very, very small pond indeed, which is the contemporary American left. But I ranted about that a little bit last week, so I'm going to refrain from ranting about it anymore this week. So, okay, the next, I'm going to have time to announce this again, but I'm going to announce it tonight. The next Libertarian Book Club Anarchist Forum is going to be on Saturday, January 31st. Mark your calendar now, and it's going to be a look back at the fascinating Lower East Side anarchist group. First known in 1966 as a Dada art movement called the Black Mask, but then in 1968 became more active, feeding the poor, setting up crash pads, occupying a Columbia University building, promoting surrealist protests, shutting down the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art as some sort of protest, providing free weekly musical events, and irritating the police. They became widely known by a name which I can't say on the radio. So use your imagination. I'm going to say that they were known as the Up Against the Wall Mother Freakers. The Up Against the Wall Mother Freakers. Use your imagination. So the speakers at the forum will be Judith Molina of the Living Theater, whose conversations with the painter Ben Morea, who was one of the founders of the Mother Freakers, led him deeper into anarchism. And Osha Newman, who was an early member of the Mother Freakers, and this year has published a book on the history and soul of the group. And by the way, I should say that for the past generation or so, Osha Newman has been living in Berkeley and is an attorney, sort of a fighting activist attorney. He's kind of like the Bill Kunstler of Berkeley, California, and has defended lots of people who were involved in the movement to defend People's Park, which was kind of like the sister movement to the movement to defend Tompkins Square on the Lower East Side, very much the same sorts of issues and happening in the same period of time back in the late 80s, early 90s. And it'll be very interesting, I think, to hear what Osha Newman has to say about the legacy of the Up Against the Wall Mother Freakers and their whole anarchist scene on the Lower East Side back in the 1960s. And presumably he'll have some things to say about what's been going on in Berkeley over the course of the past generation that he's been living there as well. So this should be a very interesting event. I'll have the opportunity to announce it again, but I'm announcing it now just because I brought up the Libertarian Book Club. So that's going to be taking place January 31st, which is a Saturday, at 7 p.m. at the Living Theater. The Living Theater is at 21 Clinton Street in the Lower East Side, just south of Houston Street. So that's either half a block south of Houston Street or a block and a half north of Delancey Street, depending on how you look at it. Once again, that's 21 Clinton Street on the Lower East Side, the Living Theater, Saturday, January 31st, 7 p.m., Anarchist Forum on the Up Against the Wall Mother Freakers, so to speak. So be there. Once again, you want the you want all this information. If you're jacked to the web, you can go to morc.info and click on our links page and click on the link for the Libertarian Book Club / Anarchist Forum. So there you have it. That is the history of the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, why we have this wacky name, why we appear to be this strange amalgam of left-wing anarchism and traditional cultures of North Africa and the greater Moorish or heretical Islamic or Berber or whatever word you want to use, world. Okay? So, you know what? Before we do the segue into the next part of the show, where I'm going to try to bring things around again to the political tip, let's hear a little bit more from Raisa Fatima Tabamrant with Taglagalt, or the Echo of the Atlas. Here, that was cut three. Why don't we go next to cut four? Good stuff. Okay, don't cry now, O Rose of the Valleys. You are surrounded by admirers, O Rose of the Valleys. Just looking at you is not enough for me. I need to pluck you with my fingers to satisfy the ardor of my gaze. Hubba hubba. Well, the liner notes tell us that that is a hymn to nature, a traditional song in honor of the beauty of nature. But one wonders if there isn't perhaps some veiled, hidden meaning there, which is a more sensual than aesthetic nature, shall we say. and a tweak at the mullahs. So, you know, we should say that we invoked the high tradition of Al-Andalus before, which was the most refined flowering of the Moorish musical tradition. And that actually survives today, not in Spain, but in Morocco as well, the sort of the music of the Moorish court. But that's not what we're listening to. We've played some of that music, and it's really, really beautiful stuff on this show as well. But that's not what this is. This is the real deep ethno-traditional stuff from the Atlas Mountains of Morocco. The real music of the Moorish mother culture, presumably unchanged since before the Arabs arrived in North Africa, and before the Romans arrived in North Africa, and before the Phoenicians arrived in North Africa. So, all right. Well, here's the segue. The segue is, you know, I think about the Berbers are continuing to carry on their political struggle today. Okay, they continue to be a marginalized minority, or perhaps even a marginalized majority. All right, they're believed to constitute in Algeria something like, by conservative estimates, 30% of the population of Algeria. They speak their own language, yet it is not recognized. And they're largely, excluded from political power. Their language is marginalized. Morocco has made some slight progress in this direction, but Algeria really still hasn't. In terms of, allowing, education and media and so on in the indigenous language of the Berbers. I should say that it's distantly related to Arabic. It's not a Semitic language, but it is what's known as an Afro-Asiatic language, which kind of is to the Semitic tongues as Indo-European is to the Germanic tongues. So, English and German are both separate languages within the Germanic language group, which is in turn a part of the larger Indo-European language family. So Arabic and Hebrew are both Semitic languages, both separate languages within the Semitic language group, which is in turn a part of the larger Afro-Asiatic language family, which also includes Berber. So that would be like a separate wing, probably as close to Arabic as, say, Spanish or Italian is to English or German. So, and they've been, they continue to be throughout most of the North African countries where they constitute at least sizable minorities, continue to be denied their full cultural rights. And particularly in Algeria, during the war, which was going on there in the 1990s and which is starting, unfortunately, to heat up again recently, nowhere near as bad as it was 10 years ago and more in the 1990s, but there's been some ominous signs lately of the war starting to heat up again. But back in the 1990s, they were really caught between both sides, because on one hand, you had the military state, which ruled in the name of Arab nationalism, and the notion of a uni-ethnic state and a unilingual state. And then on the other hand, you had, the Islamic fundamentalist insurgents who were equally hostile to the notion of Berber cultural rights and saw Berber culture as not as a threat to national unity, which is how the regime viewed it, but as a threat to Islamic identity and full of all of these subversive and heretical syncretistic traditions. So they were really caught between both sides, and they were caught in the crossfire and had their villages massacred and so on in those years. Terrible, terrible years. I wasn't even aware at the time of how bad things were in Algeria. And also with the situation facing the Tuaregs, who are sort of like cousins of the Berbers, the southern cousins of the Berbers in the interior of the Sahara Desert, who were also leading a revolt at this time. And once again, that war is also showing signs of heating up again in Niger and Mali. And in both of these cases, among the Tuaregs in Niger and Mali, and among the Berbers in Algeria, there was just wholesale ethnic cleansing, which was going on. We were all very concerned at the time about what was happening, and we did a lot of programming on the show at the time about what was happening in Bosnia. And really, things were just as bad, and we just weren't aware of it in much of North Africa during that same time. And it's only after the fact that I began to establish contacts in the Berber diaspora and so on that I really began to develop an appreciation of how bloody the situation was. So now here it is, more than 10 years later, and the Berbers are still struggling for their cultural rights. As I say, there's been some progress in Morocco. Ironically, one of the more conservative conservative in the sense of pro-capitalist and pro-West monarchical regimes in North Africa. There really hasn't been any progress in Algeria, which is conservative in a different way. I mean, the Algerian government traditionally was following liberation and was 1960, if memory serves, from the French. They were sort of a leader of the non-aligned movement and the notion of Arab nationalist socialism and Now they're sort of dropping the socialism without having dropped the Arab nationalism. So it's sort of getting sort of the worst of both worlds, continuing to be a uni-national state by official doctrine and a unilingual state by official doctrine, but they're dropping the socialism and they're bringing in, you know, Halliburton and foreign oil companies and free markets, and these big class divisions are starting to open up. And unfortunately, the popular rage is not being exploited by the left, but by the Islamic right, as is the or Islamist right, I should say, as is the case throughout much of the Muslim world. So, there's really shed some light on the protection racket or the divide and rule game, which is the very essence of the state system, is when you compare the situation of the Berbers in North Africa to that of the Palestinians. Because, of course, you know, certainly the government of Algeria, most stridently, is a extremely vocal supporter of the rights of the Palestinians, even as it is denying fundamental rights to its own Berber population. So it's pretty clear a hypocrisy here. Now, certainly, you know, what the situation which is befalling the Berbers at the moment, it's no exoneration to say that it's not as bad as what's happening in Gaza at the moment, because what's happening in Gaza at the moment is world-class, global-scale war crimes. So, once again, no exoneration to say that it's not as bad as what's happening in Gaza at the moment, although it arguably was 10, 15 years ago when the war was going on in Algeria. So, there was a picture in the paper earlier this week of a rally against the Gaza carnage in Khartoum, Sudanese marching against Israel. And my friends and acquaintances, and I have a few who are apologists for Israel, and unfortunately apologists for this criminal aggression in Gaza, were quick to make the point that, you know, this is utterly hypocrisy, you know, utter hypocrisy. How can they be marching in, how can the Sudanese be marching in Khartoum against the, what Israel is doing in Gaza when they have nothing to say about what their own government is doing in Darfur? And, well, it's a legitimate point. It's a legitimate point as far as it goes. It's a legitimate point that, yes, this is hypocrisy. Unfortunately, the sort of corollary to the point which, you know, people who jump on this are trying to make is that, you know, they're trying to dismiss all of the protests against what's happening in Gaza. And just trying to portray this completely irrational and hypocritical prejudice against Israel in the Arab and Islamic worlds. So, obviously, I don't view it that way, but I do view it, as I said once again, as a very telling illustration of the protection racket and the divide and rule ploy, which is the very nature of the state system. And there's an anarchist analysis for you. So, you know, if we lived in a better world, there would be solidarity between the Berbers, who are in Algeria, oppressed by the ideology of Arab nationalism, and the Four, the indigenous people of Darfur, the land of the Four, who are oppressed by the ideology of Islamic fundamentalism in Sudan, and the Palestinians, who are oppressed by the ideology of Zionism in their own homeland, Palestine. In a perfect world, these struggles would be in solidarity with one another and not pitted against one another. So, you know, it's really it's incumbent upon us to, just as if, this is really my point, this is really my answer to my Israeli apologist friends who pointed to the rally in Khartoum in Sudan, is that, you know, really it's incumbent, if you're arguing that it's incumbent upon the citizens of a nation to carry to protest the crimes which are carried out in their name and by their own government, then that applies to the Israelis no less than to the Sudanese. And by extension, it applies to Jews in the diaspora no less than to the Sudanese or to the Algerians. And in fact, there have been protests in Israel. I'm going to say a little bit about that, and then we'll take listener phone calls. Two people are calling in already. So in around 5 minutes, we'll take listener phone calls at 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900 is the number. If you're trying to call in now, hold that thought. We will take phone calls for 20 minutes, beginning in 5 minutes. But I just want to take issue with something which was on the front page of the New York Times today. Israelis united on Gaza war, even as censure rises abroad. Reads, voices of dissent in this country, meaning Israel, Dateline Jerusalem, voices of dissent in this country have been rare. And while tens of thousands have poured into the streets of world capitals demonstrating against the Israeli military operation, anti-war rallies here, meaning Israel, have struggled to draw 1,000 participants. The Peace Now organization has received many messages from supporters telling it to stay out of the streets on this one. As the editorial page of the Jerusalem Post put it on Monday, the world must be wondering, do Israelis believe that everybody is wrong and they alone are right? The answer is yes. Well, I take strong issue with this, okay? Now, certainly, it would seem there seems to be broad consensus in Israel in favor of the bombardment of Gaza, but by no means unanimity, just like there was broad consensus in this country in favor of the Iraq invasion. But by no means unanimity. And it's simply inaccurate that the anti-war rallies in Israel have struggled to draw 1,000 participants. All right, there was a rally just the day before. There was a rally here in New York City up on Times Square. There was a rally in Tel Aviv which drew 10,000. Okay, so that is simply an inaccuracy that they've struggled to draw. Well, maybe it's just barely accurate. Maybe in some cases they've struggled to draw 1,000 participants. But in other cases, they succeeded in drawing 10,000. And let's see. So that would have been, okay, in Tel Aviv, 10,000 protesters. Okay, now this is by the organizers' estimates, perhaps. I got this from the Gush Shalom website, Gush Shalom, meaning Peace Bloc, one of the major Israeli anti-war organizations. So, all right, this is by the organizers' estimates. Let's assume it's inflated. But I still believe that it's considerably more than 1,000, all right? So let's see. But then there were also, and this is not just by this is not just according to Gush Shalom, but according to Palestine News Network. All right, again, perhaps not the most objective source, but a legitimate source. 100,000 people marched in Sakhnin, which is an Arab city within Israel's borders, led by Arab members of the Israeli Knesset. So, all right, these are Arabs rather than Jews, but nonetheless, we're still Israeli citizens. And that's 100,000. That's pretty damn good. The largest demonstration by Palestinians within Israelis' boundaries ever, according to the organizers. Let's see. What else have I got here? Okay, there is a circulation, which is up on my website, World War IV Report, or rather a petition, which is being circulated. It's up on my website, World War IV Report, by Israeli citizens who are calling for international action against the Gaza aggression, including sanctions against Israel, to pressure Israel into coming into compliance with international law and to call off these what they consider to be violations of the Geneva Conventions. They have received 500 signatures of Israeli citizens up to this point. it's a start. Okay? Let's see. There are now, since the Gaza offensive began, there are 10 Israeli soldiers who have chosen to go to jail rather than to be deployed to Gaza. And they have cited grounds of conscience. Now, one of them was quoted in the media. A man by the name of Noam Levna, a first lieutenant in Israel's army, said, quote, "We killed 900 Palestinians in 17 days, including hundreds of children. If violence must be used, it should be used minimally, and that isn't what's happening. Killing innocent civilians cannot be justified. Nothing justifies this kind of killing. It's devilish. The hatred and anger we are planting in Gaza will rebound on us." And finally, on January 1st, I believe it was, there were 21 Israeli activists, mostly anarchists, I believe, who actually blocked a military airfield in Tel Aviv to prevent the deployment of forces for the Gaza offensive and were arrested. And I've been unable to track down details, but I understand that some of them have had their houses raided and their computers confiscated and so on since then. So there has, in fact, been protest within Israel. And this is, you know, this is the kind of action which is necessary to break the divide and conquer, the divide and rule strategy, which is the essence of the state system and the kind of thing which we applaud on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I should say one more thing. There's been some contestation about the who broke the ceasefire, and I've been trying to nail down exactly what the facts were about this whole period, which there's been very, very little reportage on, between when the ceasefire took effect in June and when Israel carried out an armed raid on the night of November 4th, election night here in the United States, when it was bound to get very little coverage in Gaza and engaged Hamas forces. And then it was subsequent to that that Hamas did not decided not to renew the ceasefire, and Israel retaliated in this massive and illegal way. So it's been apparently the calm was maintained largely. The calm is the actual word which is being used. It wasn't technically a ceasefire, but a calm. And they use the word, I believe it's tadiya in Arabic, if I'm not mistaken. Was maintained largely, but not 100% by both sides during this period, just in the name of accuracy. And I've been trying to nail down the facts. And believe it or not, I had to turn to the Wall Street Journal. international law scholar, George Bisharat, writing in the Wall Street Journal of January 10th. And the fact that he was able to get this piece into the Wall Street Journal really perhaps may signal that the tide is beginning to turn on this question. This piece was entitled, "Israel is Committing War Crimes. Hamas's violations are no justification for Israel's actions," appeared in the Wall Street Journal on January 10th. George Bisharat writes, "Israel had not suffered an armed attack immediately prior to its bombardment of the Gaza Strip. On June 19, 2008, Hamas and Israel commenced a six-month truce. Neither side complied perfectly. Israel refused to substantially ease the suffocating siege of Gaza imposed in June 2007. Hamas permitted sporadic rocket fire, typically after Israel killed or seized Hamas members in the West Bank, where the truce did not apply. Either one or no Israelis were killed, reports differ, by rockets in the half year leading up to the current attack. Israel then broke the truce on November 4th, raiding the Gaza Strip and killing a Palestinian. Hamas retaliated, actually, I believe by the media accounts I read, it was killing three Hamas gunmen. Hamas retaliated with rocket fire. Israel then killed five more Palestinians. In the following days, Hamas continued rocket fire, yet still no Israelis died. Israel cannot claim self-defense against this escalation because it was provoked by Israel's own violation." Once again, that is from the Wall Street Journal of January 10th. So the truth about the ceasefire seems to be that neither side maintained it fastidiously, but both sides maintained it largely. Israel did not lift the blockade of the Gaza Strip, which they were obliged to do under the under the calm. And there were a few rockets which were fired into Israel during that period between June and November, but they caused no casualties. So that appears to be the case. Well, I went on a little bit. I went on 3 minutes longer than I said that I would. It's now 1:13 in the morning. That's pretty good by our standards. Usually I go on 20 minutes longer than I said that I would. So now in the remaining 15 minutes or so, maybe we'll take some listener phone calls. 212-209-2900. If anybody out there has anything interesting and intelligent to say, WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio. Turn down your radio so that we do not get feedback. And speak up. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm just wondering, what do the Palestinians have been shooting rockets into from Gaza into Israel pretty steadily. What should Israel do?
All right, well, it depends on which, as I just read, it depends on what you mean by pretty steadily, because during the calm, there was more or less a calm until Israel's raid on the night of November 4th, and that's when things began to escalate again. So what should Israel do? Israel should maintain, its obligations under the ceasefire, which is exactly what you're asking of Hamas. And even, once again, I'll reiterate, as I said last week, even if you believe, and I'm not saying I believe this, but even if you believe that a military response was warranted, it should be within the limits of the Geneva Conventions and international law. There is not a syllable which can be raised in justification of the nearly 1,000 dead in this overwhelming, disproportionate, indiscriminate attack, which is clearly illegal under international law, which we have witnessed in the past, going on 3 weeks now. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up. You're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio. Please turn down your radio and speak up. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Bill. You asked if you were carrying on Peter's tradition, and I just wanted to say I thought you were very well. One thing
please use the present tense.
You are doing very well.
Thank you. Feel better that way.
One thing I do miss is Peter had an interest in fiction, especially science fiction, which he discussed from time to time, and I miss that, and it was I also miss Anne Marie's book reports that I wish from time to time she would still come on and do book reports,
book reviews. Yes, she'll be back. Don't worry, one day she'll be back.
And then just prehistory, which some of your listeners probably don't know. James Irsay,
that's right,
had two programs on WBAI. He had a music program where he played primarily piano music.
Now, what was that called?
I don't remember, but he had a second program.
Primary Sources,
where he read primary religious texts and then would comment on them. And he would, mix in with that stories from his own life and his travels, and which was very interesting. And that's the program I believe that Peter inherited.
This is true.
And so I just thought I'd throw that in.
Thank you.
And then just one more point, very small, but just a little footnote, historical footnote. And don't misunderstand this, because it's in no way meant as a defense. But you sometimes refer to Workers' World as Stalinist, and they keep it on the down low, but internally, they regard themselves as Trotskyists, and I know this because
well,
30 years ago I was a member before they expelled me for factionalizing, and
congratulations.
Thank you.
I don't want to hijack the whole thing out the Workers' World, but if I can just briefly elaborate, yes, technically I do believe that they still consider themselves Trotskyists, but they broke from the Socialist Workers' Party in 1956 over the invasion of Hungary. They supported it, and the Socialist Workers Party was, to their credit, against it. So they started moving away from Trotskyism, I would argue, and more towards a defense of the so-called actually existing socialism, or the deformed workers' state, or whatever – you know, whatever Trotskyist terminology you want to use. So they started moving back towards Stalinism, I would argue. Anyway, we'll talk about them some other time. Thank you for that call. Thank you for that call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just wondering if you can, I looked up, the Knesset, and I found that there were, I think now, 12 members of the Arab peoples in Israel who are in the Knesset. And there are 18 women who are representatives in the Knesset, which is the, you might say, the parliament or the Congress of Israel. And there are so many facts that we're not privy to, although, you know, research can bring them forth. And I'm just wondering, first of all, if you discuss even the populations, there was a Time magazine article that mentioned there were something like 560,000 Jews in Israel, but that there were a million Arabs in the Israel land, and some Arabs are Christians, not Muslims, as one would...
Okay. It's true that many of the... A substantial minority of the Palestinians are Christian. I don't have the figures in front of me, but Jews continue to constitute a majority within Israel proper, that is to say within the Green Line, not including the occupied territories. I should point out that the Ashkenazim, that is to say the European Jews who have traditionally constituted the ruling class in Israel, no longer are a majority in Israel. They're outnumbered now. I think outnumbered by the Mizrahi or the Middle Eastern Jews, and certainly if you know you take together the Israeli Arabs and the Mizrahi, they're quite significantly outnumbered. But then you've also got, of course, you know, the occupied territories, and I would include, of course, now I would include Gaza as well. So and which you know are overwhelmingly Palestinian. Are under illegal occupation. So I hope that sheds some light. WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio and speak up.
Hi, Bill, thank you very much. Great show. I went to the event tonight at the Ethical Culture Society, and it was really great. I had a lot of great speakers.
What was it about?
It was about Gaza. Chris Hedges, Cynthia McKinney, it was organized by Rev Books and I guess essentially the RCP, but that sort of had a minimal, it was kind of like a minimal component of it.
Good.
And just a bunch of other people. Edward Said's daughter did a great scene from her play on Palestine, and Vanessa Redgrave was there, just a whole bunch of people. It was really, really great, and one of the things that came up that I thought were interesting that seemed to be a dividing line was the question of Israel versus Israel being a client state, a satellite, an attack dog in the region, however you want to put it, versus Israel kind of acting in its own, as its own, with its own agency, and AIPAC kind of running the show here, so to speak. I didn't even know that AIPAC was really the problems that it had with Rabin back in the day, that it's really aligned itself with Likud, that it doesn't necessarily represent Israel, but it represents the hard right element in Israel, Israeli politics. I was wondering if you knew anything.
Well, that's increasingly the case, and of course, you know, that's the element of the Israeli political elite, which has been on top for the past many years now, unfortunately, and also the element which has been most closely wedded to the Bush administration. I tend to view I tend to be very wary of this whole notion that the tail is wagging the dog, which has elements of conspiracy theory and anti-Semitism. I tend to view it more as a marriage of convenience between AIPAC or the Jewish lobby and Likud and the Bush administration. They have converging interests. I don't think that Israel is a U.S. puppet state. And I don't think that certainly what's happening in Gaza now is not in U.S. interests, even as they are perceived by our own political elite here. And the evidence is that the U.S. at least abstained, failed to veto the United Nations Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire, which passed last week. Traditionally, the U.S. wields its veto against anything against Israel. But I do think that the U.S. is willing to put up with Israel's excesses because, well, the Palestinians don't have any clout internationally, and because Israel does serve U.S. interests in other ways and helps to keep plays bad cop with the Arab world and keeps the Arab regimes intimidated. And just as the U.S. State Department itself will play good cop, there's always, you know, Israel with its nuclear arsenal, which is there to play bad cop. And it has to make, Israel, I think, is very key to maintaining a Pax Americana in the Middle East and maintaining U.S. At least control by proxy over the oil. Now, what started to happen in the past 8 years of the Bush administration is that the neocons have been on top in Washington, and they were tired of a Pax Americana via proxy, and decided that we can't trust the Arab regimes anymore. And they had these hubristic dreams of, you know, overthrowing the Arab regimes and actually control and actually establishing a direct Pax Americana and direct U.S. military control of the oil, beginning with Iraq. And they thought that Iraq was just going to be the first domino, and then they would move on and overthrow Syria and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and completely remake the Middle East. Well, obviously that didn't work out, and Iraq turned out to be a complete quagmire, and the neocons have really been taken down a peg and humiliated. So, but that was, I think, the nature of that was the nature of the alliance, and I would argue that it's an alliance. I don't believe that AIPAC controls the United States government. I believe that it's an alliance between the most reactionary elements in Israel and the most reactionary elements in the United States. Let's see if we can squeeze in one or two more calls. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up.
Hi, this is Cloudy.
Hi.
I did want to correct one point. I don't know if in the time I've turned down the radio, someone else has made this. During the period of the ceasefire, okay, it lasted from June to November. I've been asking exactly what you've been asking, is to put that under a microscope and have progressives really study it as a model. I read that there were only 20 missiles, most of these homemade.
Right. We dealt with that. And no Israeli casualties. That's right.
Not no casualties, but only 20 in a period of 4 months.
Right. Well, and depending on accounts, either no or one Israeli casualty during that period, yes.
On the other side of the coin, the maintenance of the blockade.
Right.
The main thing that Israel was supposed to give in and didn't.
That's correct.
It was 50-50. It was more like it was 97-3.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the violations, the two sides of the ceasefire, at least as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
Super knowledgeable on the subject, but I just want to be clear that.
Okay, thank you.
Parry Delicto is wrong on that.
What?
The sort of equal fall.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Correct, thank you. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Not much time, speak up.
Hello?
Not much time, cut to the chase.
Yes, is this WBAI?
It certainly is, and you're on the air.
Yes, well, they don't give us much time.
Well, you called in at the very end of the show. Go ahead. Don't waste time.
Yes. Well,
turn down your radio, sir. Turn down your radio and cut to the chase. Turn down your radio.
I'm doing that.
Okay. All right. You got to turn down your radio and talk.
Yeah. I want to say that the Libertarian Book Club has announced that they're going to have a thing at the Living Theater on January 31st at 7
right,
o'clock.
I announced that.
That's not right. It's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh?
Yes.
All right. We'll have to look into that. We'll have that information next week. Thank you.
All right.
WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Almost out of time, so cut to the chase.
Well, Bill, yes, quickly, the American media, we have to do something to just break that whole knot where they're not talking about the dime weaponry and the complacency. Israel couldn't do it without America.
The dime weaponry.
Yes, yes. Dense, inert, metallic explosives.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before. So one media account was from the Iranian press, so I wasn't sure how much credibility to place in it. If you can get me more information, I'd like to see it. Certainly, the whole question of white phosphorus is one which finally is beginning to hit the mainstream media. That was even reported in the New York Times.
Maya's show from last month.
Oh, stop. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Okay, you know, I always like to go out on a good note, not a bad note, so hopefully the next person will have something brief and intelligent to say. WBAI on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Speak.
Hello.
Speak.
Yes, I appreciate your analysis very much, but I'm having trouble understanding your context. Now, you claim to be an anarchist, and it appears that you are against Western rationality.
No, I'm not against Western rationality. Who said that?
Well, because you have this sort of Eastern structure that you are concentrating on.
Well, I certainly don't think that my avid interest in Islamic spiritual traditions, particularly heretical and indigenous ones, is at odds with my embrace of Western rationality.
Is that a contradiction to you?
No, not at all.
Oh.
Eat jihad. Explore the concept of eat jihad. Critical reasoning is a very strong tradition in the Islamic world.
But it's not like...
WBAI, you're on the air. Real quick. No. You know, I think we might have to go out. WBAI, you're on the air. No. I should have put while I was ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, get down. Get to the chopper.
I have no idea what he said, but it sounded all right. Let's go out with a little bit more of Rayasa Fatima Tabamrat, Echo of the Atlas, traditional Berber music from the Atlas Mountains of Morocco. Stay tuned for Weaponry with Tom Whisker coming up next on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. And join us next week for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.